I'd like to introduce our speaker, Jessica.
My name is Jessica, and I am an advocate.
Thank you.
Okay.
Jessica.
Hi, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
And good morning, family. I'm among my family right now. And I just want to say the people in this room, some of the people, are my family. My closest friends, my sponsor, and sponsee, and her dad. And so I probably won't cuss because her dad's here. I don't want to take it. I'll leave the cussing out. But it's not something I did a lot. I usually did it when I was really mad at you. And that's how you knew I was really pissed. I'm grateful for recovery. This topic is called A Vision of Hope. I believe everyone in this room can stand up here and talk about a vision of hope. We all probably have something to say about the hope that we have received as a result of these gifts in Narcotics Anonymous. And I've been clean July 15th, 1986. And I have a sponsor who has a sponsor and all of that. And I was taught that. I was taught old school. And old school was sit down, shut up, and we'll call on you when we want to hear how to use or what the disease is like until you learn, you know, until you grow, until it gets better. And so what I would do is I sit in the room and I would ask to read the readings. And they told us when we were new, they said, sit up front so that you can hear. Because they said, listen like only the dying can hear. And that's what I did. Although I didn't always want to be here, but I was always kind of a compliant little kid. I would say, yeah, I'll do what you said, but then I'm gonna go and do it my way. But on the surface, I would be nice and I'd sneak off and go do what I was going to do. This topic, A Vision of Hope, is actually found in different parts of our literature. You can find it in Living Clean. There's a chapter called A Vision of Hope, just a small chapter. And it talks a lot about self-acceptance, love and compassion. And it talks about spiritual principles and how important they are, especially the longer you've been here. Because as you grow in recovery, you grow in age. And if you know what I'm talking about, you know, you just don't jump up and go like you maybe used to. I was laughing because we said everybody on the elevator was going to bed. Everybody was piling up last night. And I said, normally we would be going to the dance, dancing or staying at the marathons 24/7, but this time we were all rushing to get on the elevator so we could go and take our clothes off and take a shower. So today, we have to learn how to be, though, compassionate with ourselves as we change and grow. You know, we have to learn to not be hard on ourselves when we forget, when we make a mistake, when we lose something. I almost set something on fire last week. And all day long, I was beating myself up. And my husband kept saying, it's okay, just don't do that again. I put a paper plate in my little toaster oven, and I had forgot that it's a toaster oven. Because I've never had a toaster oven, I've always had the real oven. And I was trying to rationalize it so I wouldn't feel so bad. But he just said, don't do that no more. And then I put something in the microwave with aluminum foil one time. And this is in the last month. So once again, I'm beginning to see that I have to watch myself. But my hope is, well, my blessing is that I'm aware of it. See, and I'm not trying to deny it. You know, a lot of people I know went through mental, cognitive issues as they got older. I'm 66, but, you know, I've been through a lot in my recovery. But the hope is that there's tools, there's help, there's doctors, and there's a whole lot of things that I can do differently. See, we got a lot of tools in this program. The only problem for me is that if I don't use them, they're not going to work for me. I want to read something to you from A Vision of Hope from Just Work Today, June 12th. I'm just going to read one paragraph. It says, by the time we reach the end of our road, many of us had lost all hope for a life without the use of drugs. We believe we were destined to die from our disease. What an inspiration. A clean addict indeed is a vision of hope. So that's where I took that from. So far I've been really enjoying the convention and enjoying the theme, you know, the theme that they took from Why Are We Here? It says blah, 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 and then recovery is impossible. And I thought about how this disease of mine, I hid it for so long. For so long, I hid it. I pretend like I was okay on the outside. I could dress up the outside. I always had, and I'm one of those working addicts, and someone told me, if you still had a job, you're not really an addict. But if anyone tells you that, that's not true. You know, there's all types of addicts. You got doctors, lawyers, you know, we run the gamut. The most important thing is that that I was sick and tired of myself. And so what happened is my drug use became out of control. I used to take it to work and use. I would use it after work. I would use it in between work. And at some point, you know, in our book, and the program is here in the Basic Tech of Narcotics Anonymous, and I've always studied this book, and I've always loved my sponsor and appreciate my sponsor, because for anyone to spend time with you, come to see you in treatment, come after work, come on the weekends, and they don't get paid, you've got to give them a hand. You've got to give them a hand, okay? I never gave her, or nor did she ever ask, a thin dime. But what I do give her back is my love, my respect, my time. And there's nothing I wouldn't do for her, because we give freely what we've been given, because that's how we get to keep it. We give it away to keep it. And by the time I hit bottom, actually everybody knew but me. I was the last one to know. People at my job that worked in Pasadena, that was my area. And I also went to meetings in San Gabriel Valley. I used to go out there and LA. So when I recovered in both areas, you see. And so I was so beat down, I didn't even know it. And people would just look at me strange at work. And I said, why are they looking at me like that? And they never would ask me. And I know they wanted to. But the minute I go in the bathroom and take a hit of something, I have to leave. And finally, I just said, this job is getting in the way. You know, I don't know what it's going to take for you. And I had a career type job, okay? And I don't know what it's going to take for you to hit bottom. But for me, after I hit bottom there, I said, I'm never coming back here. Never, 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 never. But my bottom was so spiritually painful. I felt like my spirit left my body, because I could no longer look in the mirror anymore and like myself. I didn't like the things that were happening, that I was allowing to happen, just to get one more. And I knew I was better than that. That's what always got me, is that I always knew. I was going ahead, went to college for a while, and then I dropped out, and I had goals and dreams. And I've always been a planner, like, I'm gonna do all this stuff. But once you start getting loaded, all that goes out the window. You know, all that went out the window. But I always had plans. I'm the youngest in my family. So I had three sisters that were, I always say, prettier than me, smarter than me. And one of them is in recovery, and I thank God for her. She lives in Minneapolis. She's the one that kind of helped me out a little bit when I was hitting bottom. But what happened is that I passed out at work, and someone came and said, she passed out. What do we do? He said, well, take her out of here. And my sister had been talking to the person. You know how jobs have EAP? That's how I came in. I went to treatment. And I was willing at that time to do anything to stop looking at the look in my mother's eyes, to stop hurting her. I robbed her of her peace of mind, her sleep. I robbed my mother of her daughter having a normal kind of relationship. I robbed her because I lied. I really meant to go back. I just couldn't. what happened is I would take a hit and I get stuck. And if any of you guys, you know, you kind of know what I'm talking about, whatever your drug was, because we talk about the disease of addiction. It's about the disease, not one specific drug. And actually, that was the beginning of hope, because going to that treatment center transformed my entire life in July of 1986. And she came and got me. She found out where I was living, and she brought some garbage bags, the hefty garbage bags. And she threw all this stuff in the bags. It wasn't mine. I don't know whose it was, because I never cooked there. I never ate there. I was living in some kind of a drug apartment building in L.A. My car was parked. It broke down. Everything broke down on me all at the same time. And they say when we're beaten, we become willing. And I was beaten down. I was beaten spiritually, emotionally, mentally. I couldn't put two words together. I couldn't even talk without stuttering. I never stuttered. So that this disease and this allergy and this mental thing that it does to us, it just hijacks. It hijacked me. And so I ended up surrendering. Didn't know it was surrender. It was more like complying. I said, I'm going to comply and go into this place. Because my mother's crying. My father is like looking for me. They said, my father, if he took off work, you know you were in trouble, because he never not worked. He always worked several jobs to raise four girls. And he always said, Jay, if you need something, I'll help you. I said, Papa, I'm good. I don't have a problem. I remember him touching me on the leg, and I looked him in the face. And then I thought, my denial was so thick. See, when you're in the grips of denial, you cannot see past that. And they always say honesty needs to replace the truth. But I had no truth in me, because I had given my life and my will and everything. I turned it over to using. And so they asked me, how much did I use? I told them how much. Not that often. And she could look at me and see I weighed about 85 pounds at the time I went into treatment. And I went into treatment, and I ended up coming to surrender. But it wasn't overnight. It was over time. See, for me, the principle of surrender is a process. It's something that I just didn't wake up and say, okay, I surrender, here's the flag, I'm turning myself in. I did feel like I was turning myself in a way, but people already knew I had a problem. They already knew. And I had lost hope. I felt hopeless. I didn't feel that there was no other way out. And so I began to just practice some of the things that they taught us in the program. They said, get a sponsor, sit, like I said, sit up front, get a sponsor. And they said, just try to be involved as best as you can. And I remember my sponsor telling me to, why don't you take a commitment? And I said, well, what's a commitment? And she said, well, take something easy that you think you can do. Don't take something that you know is not in your wheelhouse, right? Like be a treasurer and I don't know how to count money. You know, she said, take something. Or if you take something challenging, it's going to be a challenge. So because I could count money and I like money and I like being around money, I became a treasurer of that treatment center. And we're not supposed to mention the names of the places, but it was a women's place, and it is still there today. And I just go by there and I go, wow, that's where it all started for me. Just like this convention, where it all started. And I did the commitment, and it was good to do that, because I learned how to be responsible for someone else's something. And it's funny that when it comes to other people's stuff, I could always be better, but when it came to mine, I wasn't good at all. But I knew about money, and I knew, you know, how to save and all. I knew how, you know, how it worked. After being in that place, my whole life, I got a new perspective on my life. And what happened is that I began to realize that I wanted more of the program, but the gift was that I believed that I belonged here. Still kind of thought that maybe I don't, but I said, just in case I do, I better go ahead and do what they say do, just in case I wake up and find out I really am a real, you know, I'm an addict. And so I continued to do the things that everyone else did. But there was like a small reservation in the back of my mind. And sometimes I would act out and I wouldn't do something that I'm supposed to do, because part of me felt like I don't need to do everything that everybody else does. And I think I was denying how bad I was. I kept saying I had a job, or I had this, or I had that. So at that time, it was so important for me to try to hold on to some kind of hope that, you know, my life will continue to change. And it did start to change. It got better and it started to get better. And what I didn't realize is that recovery is on the inside, it's not on the outside. Recovery is an inside job. So what had started to happen was I had started to feel better on the inside. I had started to sleep better. I had started to feel better. And I began to want to be around people. I didn't feel so shame. I didn't feel so guilty. And I had begun to practice some of the spiritual principles. And the next principle that I had learned was step two, the principle of hope. In step two, they talk about step one leaves a void. You know, once I've shared with my sponsor all the things that I had done out there, and I shared all those secrets that I said I wouldn't tell anybody, I ended up sharing everything that I could remember to my sponsor. And I was so ashamed, I asked her, could I sit on the floor with my back turned towards her? I didn't want to look her in the eye. And she was rolling her hair. That's probably why I still roll my hair today. She was using sponge rollers, pink ones, and I never thought about that till just now. And so she made me look at her, and then I tried to edit what I was saying, and she said, read exactly the way you wrote it. And when I did that, it brought a lot of pain and a lot of tears up, because I was sharing about the painful horrors of addiction, and the things that I did that I realized I was powerless over that I never knew. I was powerless over a lot of things in my life. And I had blamed myself. You know, I had one failed marriage when I was 19, and no one liked him but me. That was a sign. Like, if nobody likes your mate, let me just give you a tip. I mean, if nobody likes him, not one person in my family or friends liked him. And especially my sister and my father, oh, they couldn't stand him. The car he drove up in some kind of, with the top down, Eldorado. My father said, that won't work. You know, my father was a three job, you know, work jobs, hard work, trucker, had started his own business. It's like, you know, you're not a hardworking man. You're not coming up in here, taking my daughter nowhere. But the more they don't like them, what do? The more we go with them, the more we want it. So I failed at that, and I put 100% of the blame on me. But guys, I don't know if I'm ever 100% wrong. There's two people in a relationship, okay? So I couldn't do everything 100% wrong. He had a part to play and I had a part. So sitting with a sponsor and going through steps 2, 3, 4, 5 and all of that, I began to see that not only was he having his own experience, but it wasn't all my fault. It took two of us to tangle. And I began to kind of let up on myself a little bit more, because I felt like, God, I should have known better. How stupid can I be? And why did I stay so long? Those are the questions that I would beat myself up in relationships about. And we talk now about red flags and being aware and paying attention to things that happen. Today, I definitely pay attention. Now, I've been married 34 years, so trust me, I got the message. I definitely got the message. And this is someone who I was a close friend with. You know, I think marriage, the basis of marriage is friendship for me in my situation. And I finally got the message, because see, my grandmother said, find someone who loves you, girl. You're trying to chase people who don't love you. Find somebody who loves you. She said, because you're always trying to make them love you. And I said, that's a great idea. So again, Narcotics Anonymous, vision of hope. I began to start listening to other people. I let my grandmother, my mother, all my family were alive when I got clean in 86. They were all around, but they're all gone now. There's only my sisters and I and their kids. All the elders are gone. I'm the elder. But they had a lot of wisdom to give us. We just couldn't receive it until we were ready to hear it. And the effects that my using had on others, that still haunts me sometimes when I think about the pain I cause people. Because I always thought it's just me. But even in recovery, I could still be very self-obsessed. It just doesn't have to stop, you know, before I got here. I could be all about me. You know, I'm not pushing that wheelchair. I got things to do. You know, I could be very self-obsessed. and not want to do some of the things that I find myself doing. I live next door to my nephew who has MS, and he has a walker and a wheelchair. And I'm part of his care team, which I didn't volunteer for that either. But I'm on the team, and I've been on it for a number of years, my sister and I, because my oldest sister, when she was passing away, she asked me, she said, take care of Anthony. She said, my girls are fine. And I said, yes, because at that time, there was nothing wrong. But who would have thought that later on he would get MS, which makes it hard to walk. You know, it's a horrible illness. And who would have thought that that would have happened later? But see, my word means everything to me, you know. And there's no way I'm going to turn my back on him. And I promised her I would do it. You know, so those are some of the relationships God has brought into my life and is helping me grow and learn, because if I have a bad day, I just take one look at him and I go, that's nothing compared to what he's dealing with. He can't walk without, it's very, very difficult. I'm just going to say that. And it makes my problems look like nothing, because I have mobility. If you have mobility and you can get up and move, you got to use it while you have it before you lose it. So, you know, we talk about the message that an addict, any addict, can stop using, lose a desire to use, and find a new way to live. And our message is hope, and the promise is freedom. And the hope is that someday, you know, you too can have what Narcotics Anonymous has to offer. I never dreamed on staying this long. I had planned to read the whole book in like 90 days, and I had planned to go back to my job and then put this behind me. And my sponsor said, you have to go back to the job for one reason, to show them that your higher power is working in your life. And I said, that's the last thing I want to do, is go back and feel all that shame as I see all those people that used to see me passed out and all that. And she said, no, they need to see that there's miracles that happen. You don't have to tell them where you went and what you did, but it is important that you do that for yourself, because not only that, it gave me a big dose of humility. Every time I walked into that place, I'd look up and go, I'm back again. But this time I'm better. This time I'm clean. This time when I say I'm coming back from break, lunch, or whatever, I come back. And then I was determined, and I went overboard. I want to do even better. I wanted to never call in sick. So I went from one extreme to the next. I said, now I want to prove. So now I have this thing I want to prove to people that I was good. Prove to you that I'm not a bad person. Prove to you, you know. And one day I put the book on the desk of one of my managers, and he said, what's that? I said, I want you to read that. It says what I wanted him to know, that I'm working on, I'm trying. And he told me, I have a brother in the program, 10 years. That's why I didn't fire you. He said, because I know my brother, you remind me of him. See, so you never know what people are out there. The people around you, you never know. Some of the people that maybe you just hate or not like could be the very people that save you and help you in the end.
Yeah.
You know, so that's why I don't make enemies in Narcotics Anonymous. I don't think I have one enemy in this fellowship. Well, the boyfriends, maybe, that didn't work out. But we didn't even become enemies. We became closer when we broke up, because then we could be honest. See, this program is really based in self-honesty. It's self-honesty, self-acceptance. It's about self first. Because if I can't tell myself the truth about what's going on, how am I going to ever tell you the truth? So my vision of hope was to be able someday to do what my sponsor did. You know, maybe I can help other women. Someday, I didn't know if I'd ever do it. For 5 years, I said, I'm not your sponsor, but we can do steps together. You know, I was always reticent to do that. And people always would say, well, come on. You know, I'd meet people and I'd think, oh, I got a new friend. They go, can you sponsor me? I'm like, oh, I thought I had a friend. And then as you get older, you know, do you really make a lot of friends when you're older? In Narcotics Anonymous, you do. So a vision of hope. The hope is transformed in step 12, and that's the last part I want to talk to you about. Step 12 talks about we are a vision of hope. We are examples of the program working. And everything in step 12 talks about how once we have had a spiritual awakening, and in step 2 was when I was first introduced to a power. And it says not a power, that a power. It didn't say I had to choose something specific, but at some, the next step was going to ask me to choose in step 3. And it was going to say, choose a power greater than you, that's loving, kind, and greater than you, that can help you solve your problems. So in step 2, it was kind of getting me ready to begin to believe in something other than men and money or whatever I was believing in, success. And it told me, get ready. So step 2 made me kind of re-examine my belief system. Growing up, we went to church. Well, actually, they sent us. They stayed home. And yes, because they had to stay in church all day on a Saturday and a Sunday, and they said they would not go again for a long time. And I always had a belief in God, but mine was punishing, and that didn't work for me here. I said, no way I will have somebody that I'm praying to that I believe is watching me and that I can never do enough. I could never make it. I will never do enough. I could never be good enough because I'm always going to think bad thoughts or do something or not be honest or something. And so they said, you can have your own relationship. And when they said that, you can develop your own relationship. That's when I began to say, well, I'm not going to have what anyone else had. I'm going to have my own private relationship. And that's what I began to do. So, you know, the still small voice, the intuition, even some of the red flags that it shows me. If I deny what I see, usually it comes back around again. And I have to learn the lesson again. See, I've had to learn a lot of lessons over and over and over again. So for me, I began to now set aside that old belief system. They said sometimes it's better not to have any belief system at all than to have a bad one. So the book, that comes straight from Narcotics Anonymous. So I thank God, or either it comes from the flat book, comes from somewhere. I really don't always come up here with books, but as I said, I noticed that I'm having cognitive changes in my life, and I have seen a doctor, and it's not anything to worry about, because you can worry and make it worse, but I thought, let me do what I can while I can, and try to enjoy myself and enjoy my life. So in step 12, the hope is transformed into a gift, and the gift is sharing and giving to others. If I don't give it away, I won't be able to keep it. So that's one of those paradoxes that they talk about. But also, I was going to read something to you guys. One of my chief defects are expectations. I don't know if anybody else in here have a problem with expectations. But usually when I get mad or something doesn't go right, I tell you, usually expectations is in there. And when I do my own personal 10th step, because I do a daily couple times a week. I may not do it every single day lately because I've had something happen in my life that kind of changed my life. But once I write, I'd say about 8 out of 10 times it's expectations. I don't live in dishonesty anymore. I hardly ever have anything that's in that category, but I used to. And I've looked at how I have grown over the years. You know, it used to be dishonesty and not telling the whole truth. You know what I mean? Like leaving some stuff out. Because I can tell you some truths, but I can also leave some stuff out. And that I'm leaving out, it makes all the difference in the world. Because then you understand the full picture instead of walking around saying, what happened? So now I'm learning to trust my higher power to help me tell the whole truth of the situation. And then you understand why I did what I did or why I didn't do something. And so with that, I wanted to read one more thing to you guys. Trying to find it because I've got 1, 2, 3, 4 books. Where did I want to speak? Oh, expectations. I want to give you something from the book on that one. And so I was looking at step 2, and I was still thinking about hope, faith, courage, and all the principles. And listen to what it says about expectations. It's in the step working guide, page 16. It says that some of us may have unrealistic expectations about being restored to sanity. We may think that we'll never get angry again, or that as soon as we start to work this step, we will behave perfectly all the time. No more trouble with obsessions, emotional turmoil, or imbalance. Well, they say this description is extreme. And that's what I fell into. I fell into, well, I did everything right. Why didn't they do their part? I was doing it right. I was being honest. I was doing it. Why did they lie? Why did they do what they did? And what this is telling me is that I'm not in charge of when I'll be restored to sanity. And it's my problem. There's nothing wrong with them. I need to do what I need to do for me. And so the solution it says here is that most of us have found that we gain the most serenity by letting go of any expectations we may have about how my recovery is progressing and about what other people are doing. And that really helped me. You know, after all these years, I still struggle with certain defects of character and certain issues in my life and relationships. And that to me is human. It's just being human. Being human is to not be perfect. So before I close, I just want to share, this time last year, I went through, I don't know if you guys remember the fires that they had in the Palisades and the Eden Canyon fires. Okay, and I said I've been married for 34 years. Well, I lived in Altadena for 34 years, married to my husband for 34 years. And we knew the fires were there, and we were watching the news and all of that. And we had planned the night before how we were going to pack. And we had said we were going to put it in this bag and that bag in the morning, we said. Well, about 3 in the morning, the smoke started coming through the chimney. And it started, you know, flooding the house, the rooms, and it got heavier and heavier. My husband, I was asleep, and I was sick that night. I was sick, and the power had went out the night before. And I had went to bed early because I wasn't feeling good. And he came and said, get up. And my husband is a very calm person. He's not real, excitable type person. He's a very laid back guy. He said, get up now. And I knew then something bad had happened. And when I started smelling the smoke and I looked up at the window, I had a window in my bedroom and I could see the embers catching the tree on fire next door to me. And I heard the noise. I said, what is that noise? He didn't say a word. Well, it was the crackling of the fire. I know what it is now. And so he came back again. He said, now. I said, where's the computer? He said, no. And I looked over to where I keep my jewelry in my closet. Well, no, in my drawer. And something said, grab your pajamas and your robe because it was freezing outside. So I took my little Trader Joe's bag and I stuffed those flannel pajamas. I have top and bottom and I have a long robe. My nieces bought me real thick, nice robe. I grabbed those three things. That was all I took. And then I rushed to the kitchen because the smoke was getting worse. And there was my grandmother's ring and I heard her voice. Like I said, listen to that little voice inside. It said, you better take that ring, girl. You're not coming back. And I have my purse there. And I always keep my keys in the same place. And that's a good tip if you start having mind problems. Just be consistent and put things in the same place all the time. And I was already doing that. So I guess God was preparing me a long time ago for what's to come. Because I was always organized, putting things in the same place. But I want to wrap up and just say that my house burned down. And we left with the clothes on our back. And it was a war zone when we drove out of our driveway. Houses were on fire next door, the trees across the street. And I just looked around at my neighbors. Most of them had left. And we got no warning, nothing. No warning from the police, the fire, nothing. And we drove out of there, smoke, power lines down. And I just knew I probably wouldn't be coming back. And so that trauma right there, it's been a year now since that happened. But I just want to say, almost a year to date this year, we have our permit to rebuild, and we just got it approved. So there's hope. There's some more hope. And you know what? I never thought about using. That was the last thing on my mind. Because what would a hit or a drink, what would that do? That's not going to bring none of my stuff back. Okay, none of it. But here's what I want to say to you. Build a support group. If you're new, I want to say welcome to Narcotics Anonymous. And if you've been around for a while and you don't have a support group, build some kind of support group, because it was the people in my life who came in the hotel where I was still covered with smoke and all that, my sponsor got the girls together, they collected money, and they brought us all the things that we needed. And they asked me, what size did my husband wear? Brought him things. Not just me, they took care of both of us. My sponsor's sisters collected money. I was getting envelopes. People are still putting money in my pocket. I take it too. I go, okay, you want to give me a $100 bill? I'll take it. Because you know what? There's so much that we need. To rebuild our home is going to be a lot more than it was, 34 years ago. Because everything is more expensive. But I take it because they want to express love. And I don't want to stop them from expressing their love. It's the unconditional love of this program that was given to me. It will come back to you if you also, you know, allow people to love you. You know, let us love you until you can love yourself. Thank you so much for letting me share.
Well, let's thank the speaker for sharing her experience. Sophie has been asked to read just for today.
Thank you, Josh.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Sophie, and I'm a grateful recovering addict. Just for today, tell yourself, just for today, my thoughts will be on my recovery, living and enjoying life without the use of drugs. Just for today, I will have faith in someone in NA who believes in me and wants to help me in my recovery. Just for today, I will have a program. I will try to follow it to the best of my ability. Just for today, through NA, I will try to get a better perspective on my life. Just for today, I will be unafraid. My thoughts will be on my new associations, people who are not using and who have found a new way of life. So long as I follow that way, I have nothing to fear.
Once the meeting has circled up, readers will ask for a moment of silence, followed by the third step prayer, starting with moment of silence. Okay, we circle up.
These are knees, John.
Look.
There we go.
Oh, thank you so much.
Many of us have said,
take control of my life, guide me in my recovery, show me how to live clean, keep coming back, and work with me, work with me.
Well done, Justin.
Thank you so much, Sharon.
You got me thinking.
You were thinking about what you think.
Expectations.
Expectations.
Okay. Today's expectations. Tomorrow's presentations.
They told me
today's expectations.
Yeah, I don't know. You guys have a builder already?
We do. You're helping people, I bet.
We're just waiting for permits.
Permits are really slow. They're supposed to be expediting, but I don't know. Yeah. They don't look that expedited, but I'm okay.
Thank you very much, darling. That was great.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you for
good luck
saying
with everything.
That. Okay, all right. Thank you. Hi, how you doing? That's okay.
You know, make
good
a sign
to see
to my
you.
Mother.
Yeah.
Thank you for your being here. I can relate to your story so much.
Okay.
I want to get everybody together.
He's getting it.
Yeah, they're supposed to know that.
Oh,
there we go.
More love. Thank you, Emily.
Just in time.
Just in time. So we got to come back.
Oh, wow.
What's going on, girl?
You need to edit.